Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With us this hour, Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation and Law Professor at the University of Iowa College of Law, and Tony Goggin, Professor of Law at Drake University's Law School. We invite a couple of legal experts, often Todd and Tony, on to examine court cases before either the federal Supreme Court or the state Supreme Court. This hour, we want to examine fascinating stories and how they've become really pivotal cases that will have implications for perhaps all of us going forward this hour. Todd and Tony, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
And let's start off in the world of politics. Hey, why not? We've got a number of these that our listeners we have heard about in our news. Some of them not a little later in the hour. One that I hadn't heard of that I think Todd is going to tell us about, whether it is unconstitutional to execute someone who simply cannot remember the crime, the murder in this case, that was committed. Also a case that involves life insurance and divorce. We heard, an update about the travel ban, which will be heard, I believe, next week before the Supreme Court, a deportation case this week that was decided. And the president's appointee, Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was long touted as one of the crowning achievements of this new president, cast a deciding vote this week alongside the liberals. Justices. We'll hear about that a little bit later. But Tony, I'd like to start off with you in telling us about two cases involving gerrymandering that could have a dramatic impact, I suppose, on future elections. Gerrymandering is what? When you manipulate electoral districts to the advantage of one party or another in this case, right?
Yes, that's exactly right, Ben. The court calls gerrymandering partisan redistricting. And the two cases that are before the court right now are Benesek v. Lamone and Gill v. Whitford. And the Benesek case arises from a Democratic congressional redistricting plan in Maryland, and the Gill case arises from a Republican state legislative redistricting plan in Wisconsin. Now, gerrymandering's been around since the 1700s, but thanks to computer-assisted modeling and big data, gerrymandering is more powerful now than ever. For example, in Wisconsin, Democrats won 51% of the vote in the 2012 elections, but Republicans captured 60 of the 99 seats in the state assembly. And in Maryland, the Democratic legislature redrew the state's 6th congressional district for the express purpose of defeating a Republican incumbent. And so today, Democrats hold 7 out of 8 congressional seats in Maryland, even though Republicans consistently win about 35% of the vote in the state. What's more, polls show that the public overwhelmingly opposes gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just one problem. What are the courts supposed to do about it? And in both Benesek and in Gill, the Supreme Court justices in the oral arguments were frustrated by the fact that the litigants hadn't come up with mathematical formulas for policing partisan gerrymandering that the justices found to be compelling. And in fact, in the Gill case in October, Chief Justice Roberts called the proposed solutions gobbledygook, and he expressed the concern that the proposed solutions the plaintiffs had offered were so complicated and so difficult to understand that he said, the intelligent man on the street is going to say that's a bunch of baloney. It must be because the Supreme Court preferred the Democrats over the Republicans. And then during oral argument in the Benesek case in March, Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, was still clearly not satisfied with any of the solutions that have thus far been proposed. And the court hasn't ruled yet. But at this point, it is not clear what they're going to do.
And by what you're saying, it's all going to hinge on whether you have a solution that makes sense here. Because I guess the court admits, since it's been around for more than a couple hundred years, that gerrymandering to some extent will exist as long as we have, I guess, something that is not akin to what Iowa does when it redistricts, which is nonpartisan. We have most states putting the power of redistricting in the hands of the party in power every 10 years. Am I more or less right?
Ben, you're exactly right. And indeed, that is the heart of the problem because Congress could come up with a solution itself without having to get the Supreme Court involved. 3 years ago, the Supreme Court, in a case out of Arizona, stated that Congress has full authority over congressional redistricting. Accordingly, Congress could order every state legislature to adopt a nonpartisan redistricting process, at least for federal elections, congressional elections, such as what Iowa has with the LSA. But the catch is, the party in power is the party that's benefited from partisan redistricting, so they have no incentive to change the system. And that's why the Supreme Court stuck with this issue.
All right. Similar to getting money out of politics. Everybody would wish we had no money in politics, or most people, I think, polled would say, let's get the big money out of politics. But it's people in office who are working on the system that currently exists and are not likely to get rid of it, right?
Exactly right.
Interesting. And so any sense there, Tony, on what the court is thinking, reading the tea leaves at all?
There is a hint that came out in oral argument, and that is Justice Breyer, who we know is very critical partisan redistricting. Justice Breyer proposed that the Wisconsin and Maryland cases be held over for re-argument next October. So in other words, the court would not issue a ruling this spring. They would tell the parties to show back up at the court in October, and the Maryland and Wisconsin cases would be joined by a case out of North Carolina. And the idea of that would be to allow the litigants who are asking the court to find a constitutional formula for striking down gerrymandering to work together and come up with some kind of coherent, persuasive, judicially manageable standard for the court to rely on. But the catch is, for 14 years since the last time the Supreme Court heard a gerrymandering case, the Supreme Court's been waiting for a standard that's workable. So it's not clear why delaying the case for six more months would get us any closer to a solution.
And Tony, lest we think this has few implications, it has great implications. We have to look to Pennsylvania, which redrew districts. Let me see if I'm getting this right. Redrew districts because of the similar situation to Maryland and Wisconsin. And it looks like the Democrats will pick up a number of seats.
That's exactly right. The Republican Party had a 13-5 advantage in Pennsylvania's congressional districts, but because of the new redistricting plan that the state Supreme Court has required to be adopted, it's believed that the Democrats have a really good shot to win 9 out of the 18 in November. And right now, the Republican majority in the House is 23 seats. So Pennsylvania alone could give the Democrats 4 of the seats they need to retake the House. So that's a really good example, Ben, of how state Supreme Courts are starting to take the lead where the U.S. Supreme Court has not been able to find a solution itself.
4 seats out of 23 needed to flip the House into the Democratic column. Interesting. Tony Goggin, professor of law, Drake University Law School. Todd Pettis with us as well, the University of Iowa Law School. Todd, let's keep in the political vein. Can I ask you about this political apparel case that we've been hearing about? So you show up to vote, and it matters in Minnesota what you wear.
Yeah, it's a First Amendment free speech case. What do you have a constitutional right to wear when you go to the polling place on Election Day? And Minnesota's law is similar to laws in about 10 states, but all states have one kind of law or another. Minnesota's is just one example that responds to what life was like back in the 1800s. In the 1800s, polling places were really pretty wild places. There were folks out there with money in their pocket approaching voters as they walk up to the polling place, offering money to buy votes. Ballots were colored, you know, for particular candidates or parties, so everyone could see who you were voting for. There was no secrecy about it. Employers would watch their employees and to see how they were voting. So they're very different places and in the very different setting in which to vote. And at the end of the 1800s, there was a sweeping wave of change in the United States, and states responded in differing ways. Here in Iowa, and in fact in all states, we have a law that bans electioneering in the polling place. So you can't stand there where they're taking names at the table and be persuading people. You can wear what you want, however. So if you have a Make America Great Again t-shirt or an I'm With Her t-shirt on when you voted in the most recent election, that's fine. You could wear that to the polling place. But after you voted, you then needed to leave, because if you stayed and loitered, then you're now campaigning because you're standing there kind of as a billboard for these candidates.
Right.
Well, some states have gone further. So some states have said, well, we're not going to let you wear campaign stuff. And Minnesota is one of the group of states that said, we're not going to let you wear anything that's political. So in today, if you wanted to wear a Tea Party shirt or a MoveOn.org or an AFL-CIO t-shirt or button, that's not allowed. And in Minnesota, we had some voters who wanted to wear Tea Party shirts and Don't Tread on Me shirts to vote. They got tripped up when they showed up and gotten some arguments with election officials. And so we have this litigation challenging the ban. The case was argued back in late February. We'll have a ruling sometime between now and the end of June. And really what the focus here is on those polling places. Are they places for free speech or are they not free speech places? It's certainly free speech insofar as casting a ballot is speech, but do you have speech rights that extend beyond that? And we have really two very opposite ways we could go. We could say, yes, this is an occasion for political speech. People want to kind of carry their political messages in with them. That's very much part of the politics, and those rights get great protection. And if that's the road we go, we would say to the states, you have to have a really compelling reason mm-hmm. for doing this. There's another view that would say these are what the law would call a non-public forum. What that means is this is government property that's just, it's not a free speech zone. And so the government can restrict your speech so long as it's doing so in a reasonable way. And those are two very, very different choices. Now, in a case back in 1991, the Supreme Court upheld the kind of law that Iowa has, these laws that say you can't actively campaign in a polling place. We know that those laws are constitutional. And in that case, the justices split about which of these two roads to go down. There were some justices who said we need to demand a really compelling justification, but we have one. And then there were others who said, well, all we need is a reasonable justification, and we have one. So when you listen to oral arguments to try to see which way is this going to go? Justice Alito was clearly, I would say, among the leading skeptics of this law. He came to the oral argument with a long list of examples saying, well, what about this? What about this? And one of the most interesting, I thought, was he asked the counsel for the state, which was defending the law, suppose someone wanted to wear a T-shirt that just had the text of the Second Amendment, the Right to Bear Arms Amendment of the Constitution, just to quote the Constitution, would that be allowed? And the state said, no, that would be political, because in today's climate, gun rights relate to who we should vote for, who we should put in office. So it's taking a position, even if just implicitly or indirectly, on what our choices should be at the ballot box. So the state says, no, we wouldn't allow that. And that's pretty extraordinary. Justice Alito thought so. You can't wear quotations of the United States Constitution to the polling place. When you look at trying to figure out where, and Justice Sotomayor, I think, is clearly on the side of leading the charge to defend laws like this, a lot comes down to predicting where some of the court's newcomers are going to come down, Justice Gorsuch in particular. And we didn't get much of an indication at oral argument, but I think one thing worth noting is back in that case, that older case where the court said it's okay to ban active campaigning, electioneering at polling places, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion. He was among the justices who said that ban is okay. And his rationale was these are not free speech zones. State rationales for restricting speech just have to be reasonable. Okay, just has to be kind of a plausible, reasonable sounding thing that government's trying to do. And if that's the view you take, I think Minnesota's law, the odds of it being upheld go up substantially.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Second Amendment there in a First Amendment case. Let me focus on the Second Amendment. Obviously, something in our news very often, something that divides our country in a lot of ways. The right to bear arms. Now, it seems the U.S. Supreme Court has, and we've done this for a number of years, Todd and Tony. We have a lot of free speech cases. Not so many right to bear arms, Second Amendment cases. Is it that the U.S. Supreme Court shies away from Second Amendment cases more often than free speech, Todd?
I think it's a function of where we stand right now in history. I think when 50 years from now, we won't be saying that, which is to say there's going to be a wave of Supreme Court cases coming. We just haven't gotten them yet. And the reason I say that is it's only recently that the Supreme Court has said that the Second Amendment protects the individual's right to have guns, at least handguns, in the home for self-defense, and that states have to are restricted by this amendment in addition to the federal government. Those are rulings that date back to 2008 and 2010. Those rulings have unleashed a flood of litigation in the lower courts. There is a lot of litigation in the lower courts about all kinds of different gun restrictions, and people who are losing in those cases try to take their cases to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declines to hear them. And I think what they're doing is they're letting the lower courts wrestle with, you know, really the myriad issues that are literally life and death issues, wrestle with what the test should be, what are the kinds of legal lines that should be drawn. And at some point, the Supreme Court's going to get involved in answering those. It's just, you know, the Second Amendment's a relative newcomer to the scene.
And I just counted 26 words. This is all about 26 words.
Yeah.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Tony, anything to add to that analysis by Todd?
Sure, Ben. I agree with everything Todd said, and I just add that there's a big circuit split right now at the Federal Intermediate Court of Appeals level over what the word bear means in the Second Amendment, because 10 years ago, as Todd referred to, there was a case called D.C. v. Heller in which the Supreme Court interpreted what the word keep means in the Second Amendment, the idea that you can keep a firearm in your home. But what are the outer limits on your right to take a firearm out of your home into onto public property or into the community? And the circuits have gone in lots of different directions. New Jersey's got a very restrictive law regarding that, which has been upheld by the federal appellate courts, whereas Illinois had an almost identical law that was struck down by the Seventh Circuit. So I have to say I'm surprised the Supreme Court hasn't granted cert yet to a case to resolve that circuit split. But I agree with Todd. I think we're going to see a big Second Amendment cases in the future.
Mm-hmm. And it was only a couple of weeks ago that a former Supreme Court justice recommended the repeal of the Second Amendment. Stevens?
Justice Stevens wrote an op-ed, I think it was for the New York Times, saying that the time had come to repeal the Second Amendment. And I think it's fair to say that it was not warmly embraced by many. People on the right obviously opposed that because they don't want gun rights taken away. People on the left said, you've just confirmed the worst fears of conservatives. Whenever we talk about gun restrictions of any kind, the argument is made for those who favor gun rights, this is just the leading edge of what's coming. They really want to take away all your gun rights. And then here Justice Stevens came saying there should be no constitutional right ever to have a gun.
Mm-hmm. Also in the news, who can comment on the fact that the Supreme Court justice nominated by Donald Trump, Neil Gorsuch, that fiery political upheaval that happened over the course of a year to get Neil Gorsuch on the bench. Donald Trump has long touted him as one of his crowning achievements. He cast the deciding vote this week against the administration on an issue at the center of the president's agenda, namely deporting immigrants who commit crimes in the U.S. Tony, your thoughts on that case, that ruling?
Sure, Ben. That case is called Sessions v. DiMaia. And just as you said, Gorsuch joined the liberals in ruling that the administration, or more precisely, the federal agency that interprets the Immigration and Naturalization Act, had it exceeded its authority because the underlying statute was too vague for constitutional purposes. What's interesting about it is that the particular individual was a man from the Philippines who was a green card holder, and he'd been convicted twice for burglary. And the issue was, were those crimes of violence? Because if they are crimes of violence, then you can be very quickly deported. And the Justice Gorsuch sided with the liberals in holding that the statute was too vague to be enforced against Mr. DiMaia in this case. Here's the really interesting thing. Gorsuch's reasoning likely was quite different than the liberals on the court, in that Gorsuch is somebody who has argued at the Intermediate Court of Appeals level that federal agencies have been given way too much discretion to interpret federal statutes. And he's basically argued that federal agencies have been making law rather than simply interpreting and applying law. And his views are very conservative on this. And so this is a good example of how you can reach the same result whether you go from a liberal perspective or conservative perspective, but the implications of your result depend very much on what the future makeup of the court is. So in other words, Gorsuch may have sided with the liberals on this issue, but he's articulating a vision of federal agencies that could lead to a dramatic restriction in their ability to actually interpret the law. And this could have very significant ramifications in the area of environmental law, where historically the EPA has been given pretty broad latitude to interpret federal statutes. Gorsuch is charting a course that could lead to a very significant restriction in the EPA's freedom of movement, to use just one example.
Liberals need not celebrate this as a sign of things to come, saying that Gorsuch is a sheep in wolf's clothing,
well,
reverse it that way.
Certainly, I think that his vote should not be something that liberals necessarily celebrate. But at the same time, we don't know that much about Gorsuch. He was clearly a very conservative judge at the Intermediate Court of Appeals level. But Supreme Court justices have a tendency to be unpredictable. David Souter is the most famous example. He was appointed by George Bush in the early 90s, and he was supposed to be a conservative but ended up being quite liberal. So I'd say the jury's still out on what the future holds for Gorsuch.
Mm-hmm. Todd, you feel the same? The jury's still out on Gorsuch, this newest Supreme Court justice?
Yes, I think I agree with that. I feel pretty confident in saying he is going to remain a quite conservative justice. But that's just speaking at a really high level of generality. You know, when you talk about judges and justices who are either conservative or liberal, you know, they're not produced in factories like factories that make Oreo cookies or something, where everyone looks exactly like the other one. There's a lot of room for disagreement and nuance and so forth. And to, you know, seize on one case and try to make strong projections would be a really perilous thing. So I agree with Tony. This is nothing for liberals to celebrate, and it's nothing for conservatives to get particularly worried about. His voting pattern so far, he's now been on the court for about a year. His voting pattern overall has tended to be quite conservative. But as Tony said, you know, justices can change over time. And there's some studies that show that the longer a person's on the court, sometimes the more they tend to drift left. It's rarer for someone to kind of start left and drift right. But
Interesting as to why that is, but we have plenty of wood to chop in the second half hour. We have to take a short break. I'm looking at the cases. Fascinating cases we'll be touching on after a short break with Todd and Tony. Whether it's unconstitutional to execute someone who simply cannot remember the crime, a case that involves life insurance and divorce, a case that involves the warrantless seizures of cell phone records to track a phone user's movements. Several others here. Also, I want to ask our legal experts sometime in the second half hour whether the potential firing of special counsel Bob Mueller could, in any scenario, find its way to the Supreme Court. Remember, in 2000, the Supreme Court decided the Bush and Gore case. We'll talk about it when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tony Goggin, professor of law at Drake University. Todd Pettis, likewise, a law professor at the University of Iowa. And they are legal experts this hour as we're going through somewhat in depth, about a dozen cases before the U.S. Supreme Court in the current session. Got about a half dozen to get to. Let's go to you, Tony. I want to hear about this cell phone records case. So I commit a crime and I have my cell phone on me, or the investigators want to find out about my movements when I claim innocence. What is at stake here? What is the question before the court?
Right. That's the case of Carpenter v. United States. And the issue that the case is put before the court is whether the warrantless seizure and search of historical cell phone records that reveal the location and movements of a cell phone user is permitted under the Fourth Amendment. And the key point is our cell phone data records are held by third parties, by our cell phone companies. And historically, the Supreme Court has held under this thing called the third-party doctrine, that you have no reasonable expectation of privacy mm-hmm. when you share this sensitive information. But the facts of this case are really kind of interesting. The case arises from a series of armed robberies in Michigan and Ohio in 2010 and 2011. And federal prosecutors quickly identified a man named Timothy Carpenter as one of the suspects. And what the government wanted was to find out where he was on the day of the robberies. So they went to a federal magistrate judge and got an order sent to Carpenter's telecommunications provider, directing it to provide detailed records of the calls he made, as well as using cell phone tower information where he was located. But the government did not restrict its request to the days of the armed robberies. The government asked for all cell phone records regarding him for a 152-day period. And the most important point is the prosecutors did not get a warrant. They instead used something called the Stored Communications Act that just requires the government to provide evidence that the records sought are relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. Well, the magistrate agreed, issued the orders. Metro PCS and Sprint, the cell phone companies, provided 186 pages about Mr. Carpenter, and indeed he was convicted and sentenced to 116 years behind bars. Now, case precedent would suggest he's going to lose because of the fact that he had shared this information with his cell phone provider, sort of inherently. But what's interesting is the justices in oral argument were clearly concerned by the speed with which technological change is moving beyond our traditional understandings of the Fourth Amendment. So there's a possibility here that the court's going to try to draw the line in a way that might be more protective of rights than we've seen before in the context of some sort of third-party vendor holding information. But there was a bad sign for Carpenter. During oral argument, Justice Kennedy, who's a crucial swing vote, Kennedy said, "If I know the cell phone company has my location data and phone call records when I share it with them, then everybody does." And when he said that, the whole courtroom erupted in laughter because Justice Kennedy's 81 years old and he was getting at the idea that he's not exactly, you know, an IT genius or expert. And so that was an indicator that he may not be that sympathetic to Carpenter's particular case. But the broader issue of our privacy rights in an age of the internet and the age of cell phones is something that clearly concerns the court.
Okay, something definitely to watch there, Tony. Todd, let's stay in the area of criminal law. There's a death penalty case before the Supreme Court that has an interesting, alibi is the wrong word. What would you say?
Well, a reason not to execute me is falls in that category of cases. And it's timely today in this sense that 33 years ago yesterday, okay, so April 18th, 1985, a man in Mobile, Alabama, his name's Vernon Madison. He was then in his mid-30s. He shot and killed a police officer. The police officer was at the home of his of Vernon Madison's former girlfriend. Vernon was there to retrieve his things. The girlfriend wanted protection, so the police officer was there and in his car just kind of watching, make sure things were okay. Vernon Madison crept up behind him and shot him in the head and killed him. He was convicted of murder. He was sentenced to death. That was 33 years ago. He's now in his mid-60s. He's had a series of strokes. As a result of those strokes, he walks with a walker, his speech is slurred, he has some other physical problems, and crucially here, he cannot remember the crime. And so he says it would violate the Eighth Amendment to execute me. The Eighth Amendment says you can't cruelly and unusually punish someone. Now, what we already know is the Supreme Court says that if you have a mental illness that makes you unable to understand that what you did was wrong, or that makes you unable to understand that the reason you're being executed is because you did something wrong and this is the punishment, then it's unconstitutional to execute you. But that description doesn't fit Mr. Madison. He is perfectly with it mentally. He understands that he committed a murder.
And before the stroke, he did have a memory of it.
Yes. Yes, he did. And so he knows that he committed a crime. He knows that it was wrong. He knows that the reason he's slated for execution is that this is the punishment. He just simply cannot remember it among many other things from earlier in his life. And so the question is, does this violate the Constitution to execute him? This case was up in front of the Supreme Court just last year in November, and the Supreme Court refused to grant him relief just for some procedural reason and reasons, and it's not worth getting into the weeds to figure out why, but the Supreme Court said, you know, we can't give him the relief that he wants. The case went back to the state courts, and now it came back in January, and with half an hour to go before his execution, so by that time, I presume he was already in the lethal injection chamber, the court granted a stay so it could ponder whether to take his case, which now was procedurally coming to them kind of in a different way that would allow the court to address the merits of this claim. And over the dissent of a few of the justices, the court said, yes, we want to take a look at this. So this case will be back in front of the Supreme Court this coming fall sometime, asking this question. And so it's an interesting question for people to think about because, yes, the court will be deciding based on law and precedent and so forth, but it's very much a philosophical question that you can think about. Just, you know, when we kill someone, what do our, in the language of Eighth Amendment law, say? What do our evolving standards of decency say? Would it be indecent? Does it strike us as wrong to kill someone who can't commit their crime? Now, if you're opposed to the death penalty—
Can't remember their crime.
Yeah, exactly, if you can't remember the crime. If you're opposed to the death penalty, all these questions are easy. You know, any sentence that begins, can you execute a person if? You say, I don't care what comes after the if. It's wrong. Right. But if you have an open mind that, yes, death penalty be appropriate in some cases, okay— From that point of view, if the person is sane, they don't suffer from a mental illness, but they just simply cannot remember, does that violate our sense of decency to execute that person? And that's the question the court will be taking a look at later this calendar year.
Okay. Dunn v. Madison, that court case, if you wanted to look online and find out more about it. Tony, let's go to you because you want to tell us briefly. We've got a few more cases to get through before the end of the hour, but we certainly have a number of public employees belonging to unions listening to us this hour, and Iowa recently passed some laws in this area. So I'm not sure the degree to which it affects Iowans as public service employees, but tell us about this union fees case.
Right, Ben. This is a big case. It's called Janus v. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And the case comes out of Illinois, and the fundamental legal issue is a constitutional challenge being brought by an Illinois public sector employee to state law that mandates the payment of union fees by all public sector employees. Under Illinois law, the reason state employees are required to pay union fees to their local union is to support the union's collective bargaining with management in regard to things like pay, wages,
right.
hours, and conditions.
Because everybody
of employment.
Gets the benefits that are bargained for, right?
Exactly. And for 40 years, the Supreme Court has held that there's a concern over the free rider problem, that if you aren't paying in but you're deriving the benefits from it, that's not right. But in this case, the legal challenge is one that's founded in the First Amendment. The employee is a man named Mark Janus, and he argues that the mandatory union fees violate his First Amendment rights because he says he's being forced to subsidize union speech to influence government policymakers that he doesn't agree with. And the Supreme Court's always recognized that there is a First Amendment concern here. In this case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education back in the 1970s, the Supreme Court said that employees can't be forced to pay for union activities that are political or ideological in nature, but they can be forced to pay for the bargaining, to pay union fees that are used as part of the bargaining process with the government and for administering the resulting contract. So what this case, the Janus case, is really going to do is determine whether or not that Abood case from 40 years ago is still good law. The signals don't look good for the union. The conservative majority in the Supreme Court has been chipping away at it and has been chipping away at Abood in recent years. And at oral argument, Justice Kennedy made it pretty clear that he's likely to vote with the conservatives. He has very tough questions about compelled speech to the union's lawyer. Interestingly, though, Justice Gorsuch did not say a thing. Mm. If he were to actually vote with the liberals on this, and I don't think there's any reason to expect that he would, but if he would, I would say that would make a far bigger impact than in the Sessions case we talked about before the break, because this has historically been such a target of conservative critics of unions, the idea of mandatory union fees. So this is a case that ultimately will affect millions of union-represented public sector employees around the country one way or the other.
And dramatically affect our political landscape as well, unions being weighing in generally on the side of the Democratic Party. Let's go to another case. This is an interesting case that has not been in the news very much, to my knowledge, Todd Pettis. You have life insurance, and then usually your spouse is your is the one who benefits in the case of your death, right? Perhaps to the tune of 100% of whatever life insurance, a million, I don't know. Then you get divorced. This deals with what happens then, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you have gotten divorced or you're thinking about it, you really need to know just a little bit about the law in this area. And then we'll get quickly to the constitutional issue that the court is considering. But in about half the states, including this one, including Iowa, the state makes an assumption that if you're married and you have designated your spouse as the beneficiary on your life insurance policy, the state assumes that when you get divorced, you want to change that designation. You don't want your now former spouse to be the beneficiary. And so they have adopted statutes that do it automatically. So if you have gotten divorced in Iowa, or you're going to get divorced, there's a statute that says automatically, without you doing a thing, your life insurance policy designation of your former spouse as your beneficiary is now canceled. You can override it. You can write to your insurer a letter and say, no, I know I've gotten divorced, but I want to reiterate, I want to keep this person as my beneficiary. That's okay. Okay. But absent that, the designation is canceled. Well, this comes as a surprise to some people because they don't know or their divorce attorneys didn't tell them they needed to take a look at this. The issue that's in front of the court has to do with a clause of the Constitution that we don't talk about often. It's a clause that says no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. And the question is, if you have a life insurance contract with someone, and then after that, your state adopts this law that is going by law to change your beneficiary designation, does that violate this constitutional provision? And so just for those who think this may have some bearing on them, Iowa adopted its law and it became effective July 1st, 2007. So that's getting a ways back, but there are still people who are impacted by this. So if you bought your policy prior to 2007, then this statute comes into play, and then you've gotten divorced. The law says your former spouse isn't the beneficiary anymore. Is that a constitutional violation because this newly adopted statute has changed the changed the contract? So that's what's in front of the Supreme Court involving a couple who got divorced in Minnesota. And the court will return to this contracts clause, which the court hasn't decided a great number of cases under in recent time. We'll find out more about what it means.
Mm-hmm. Also, Todd, quickly before our show winds up here. We've heard about this in the news, when states can require an out-of-state seller to collect taxes for goods sold in purchases within the state. I think everybody leaps to Amazon here in this case, right?
Yeah, Amazon actually is more of a good guy than you would think. Amazon has, last year, they started to collect sales tax on all the sales when you buy something from them. The Amazon marketplace, the so-called third-party sellers, they don't collect sales taxes for them. And some other very, very large online retailers have started to collect sales taxes, but most don't. And it's costing states every year billions of dollars. The federal government in a recent study estimated that somewhere between $8 and $13 billion in sales taxes are going uncollected. Here in Iowa, the federal government estimates that the state of Iowa is losing between $100 and $150 million because out-of-state sellers, retailers, sell stuff online to Iowans. They don't collect a sales tax, and so the money doesn't get collected. Now, we are supposed to go there's a form that you're supposed to file when you buy something from someone out of state online and they don't collect sales tax. Under Iowa law, we're supposed to pay a tax. It's called a use tax.
You mean you don't pay that, Todd?
Well, I will. I'm going to plead the Fifth Amendment, but I'll just tell you that it's only relatively recently in my life that I've gone to the Iowa Revenue Department's webpage and said, you can download the form and you're supposed to fill it out and send in. Well, the compliance rate is, studies show, fewer than 5%. Almost no one does this. And so all this money is just going uncollected.
Mm.
And So the Supreme Court is being asked to take a look at this. The reason it's going uncollected is because right now there's some Supreme Court precedents in place that place obstacles on states' ability to force those out-of-state sellers to collect. Those older Supreme Court rulings, which are kind of pre-dot-com cases, mm-hmm. those cases say that if a seller doesn't have some kind of a physical presence in your state, like a sales force or a warehouse or a call center or something, then you can't force them to collect the tax. Congress has looked at this. Congress could fix this problem, but they don't want to be part of raising your taxes even indirectly, so they haven't acted. And so states, South Dakota here, going to the Supreme Court saying, please overrule those earlier cases, remove this obstacle, so we can now start collecting these taxes.
Hmm. Interesting. Our hour coming to an end, 3 or 4 minutes left. I wanted to get to this question since it is in the news, the speculation of whether the president will fire the special counsel, Bob Mueller. We've had the Supreme Court as recently as 2000. Actually decide who the president would be, George W. Bush in that case. Is there a scenario that either of you see where the Supreme Court could get involved should the president choose to fire or try to fire the special counsel? Tony, have you thought about this question?
Oh, sure, Ben. I think there are a couple different scenarios where it could end up in the courts. The president basically has two options. One is he could attempt to fire Mueller directly. By doing so, he would violate a Justice Department regulation, but he might argue that the regulation itself is a violation of the Constitution because it restricts the president's Article II authority. I think that would likely end up in the courts as long as Mueller were to bring suit, because there's a standing issue here. A person on the street couldn't file suit. You need the person who suffered the injury. The second route, which has been discussed, is that what the president might do is force Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, to resign and then replace him with Scott Pruitt, who was confirmed by the U.S. Senate to serve as the EPA director. There's a federal law called the Federal Vacancies Act of 1998 that allows the president to replace a cabinet secretary with another cabinet secretary for a period of about 210 days.
With no confirmation needed.
Exactly. And so if that were to happen, Pruitt could then fire Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and take over Mueller's investigation. The one catch with that is we don't know if the Federal Vacancies Act would permit a president to do that when the vacancy was created by the president himself by firing the attorney general. This is why, at least it's believed, this is why the president's been pressuring Sessions to resign, because if Sessions resigned, then clearly the Federal Vacancies Act would allow the president to do this. If the president fires Jeff Sessions, then things get dicier from a legal perspective. But those would be the two routes I see that could lead to a court case.
Todd, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I totally agree with Tony's very good analysis there. The Senate is contemplating, or some in the Senate are talking about adding an extra level of protection for Special Counsel Mueller, where if the president were to say, or the president's people are to say, you're fired for a cause, there'd be this quick term of, or quick period of judicial review. There would be constitutional questions conceivably around that, too, about whether that statute is going too far and infringing the president's ability to determine who and who is and is not actually serving as a prosecutor for the executive branch.
Does it matter in this case what reason the president would give for firing Bob Mueller? He's given reason to NBC News, Lester Holt, saying it's about the Russia investigation. Now, this week he said, it wouldn't be about the Russia investigation, firing of Bob Mueller. Now, does the reason figure into the legal matter here at all, Todd?
It does. The Department of Justice regulation that Tony made reference to says, first of all, the president himself can't do the firing. It can only be the attorney general or the person who's acting as the attorney general to supervise the prosecution or the investigation. And also, it can only be for a good cause. And Tony, I don't know whether you recall the exact language that shows up in the regulation there, but it's not an open door. It's only if, in some way he's falling short in the job and is not an effective prosecutor.
Okay. I guess we'll leave it there. Fascinating. Hopefully something, perhaps something that will not have to be faced by this Supreme Court. We go back to the year 2000. Many of us have that in our living memory. When with Gore v. Bush, that was the case, right?
I'm sure the justices are not eager for this case to reach their desks.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with Todd completely.
All right. Tony Goggin, professor of law at Drake University Law School. Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan B. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa. Tony and Todd, so good to dig down deep in this dozen cases or so this hour before the U.S. Supreme Court. We look forward to having you back to do some more explaining of cases that are in the news and many of them that we hadn't heard about that have implications for our lives. Thank you very much, Tony and Todd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Lulu Dewey. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Also suggest a theme or a topic for a show. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. News Buzz tomorrow. I hope you'll tune in again. Thanks for joining us.